With regard to the sons, the four sons, you'll notice something interesting, just in the wording. You have to pay careful attention to the wording. The first one is the Chacham, the wise son. Mahu Omer, what does he say? What are these testimonies and statutes, ordinances, that the Lord our God commanded you? The Afat to Emarlo, and also you are to say to him, Ki Hilchos HaPesach, like the Hilchos HaPesach, like the laws of Pesach. Ein Maftirin Achara Pesach Afikomon. That is, that we do not have any dessert, we don't have any food after the eating of the a Pesach. I think that's a halacha that everybody's familiar with. That is that, well, we don't have the Karban Pesach today. We don't have the Passover sacrifice. However, it's not to be forgotten. In a sense, we do have it because we have a substitute. And we call it the Afikoman. This is a very interesting halacha. And that is that we eat the matzah at the end of the meal. I think everybody is familiar with the procedure. That is, we eat matzah twice. We eat matzah at the outset of the meal. And according to most halachic opinions, that's for the sake of fulfilling the basic mitzvah of eating matzah on that night. And of course, we eat it in a reclining position. And then we have other things that we eat, the bitter herbs, then we eat the sandwich. And then we have the meal. At the end of the meal, and here's the challenge. The challenge is to leave some room, so to speak, to be able to continue to eat. Because if you're in a situation where you're so stuffed that you can't eat, you will not be able to fulfill Afikoman. Afikoman is a mitzvah, to eat the Afikoman. And any mitzvah that entails eating must be considered real eating, and halakhically speaking, if a person is so full that it's literally painful to eat anymore, so he doesn't fulfill the mitzvah. Because that is not considered to be eating. The term is achila gasa for that. It means he just stuffs something down, but that's not considered eating. So then you eat the afikoman. The idea of the afikoman is that it is representative of the Passover. It's in the place of the Passover, which is a very interesting idea, and it teaches us something. Because one of the questions that we have is, why is that halacha, that law, selected to be communicated to the wise son? That's one of the questions, and we'll return to that. But there are a number of questions that emerge as we consider the structure of this paragraph, the wording of this paragraph. The question that was posed, which initiated the discussion, is the simple word va'af, and also. How does that fit in? It should have simply said what the Chacham says, the wise son says, and it should have said v'ata emarlo, or you could even leave out ata emarlo. You could simply like this, ve'amarlo, and say to him. So there are two words that are superfluous. Va'af is the main one. And also, what does that mean? What do you mean? And also, also always, the term also always seems to include something else. That's when we use it. We make the basic statement, then there's an addition to the statement, so we use and, the conjunctive. But you don't start off with and. You say to him. Now, of course, if you wanted the flow of the conversation, then you could say, and you say to him. That brings everything together. But the word af would seem to be superfluous. The next question that I want to raise is, the Haggadah over here is giving us instruction. The obvious point being that education is the fundamental objective of the evening. And what's amazing about the Haggadah, this is an expression of what Judaism is about, and you have that specifically in the mitzvot that pertain to this night. This is a religion which proclaims study me. That's the motto of our religion, study me. Therefore, we have the philosophy of education expressed in the Haggadah. It's an educational manual. So, one of the significant educational discoveries of Judaism is that the education is meaningful only insofar as it's in tune, in line, with the makeup of the student. You don't have one education fits all, because education relates to a student. The students, there are different kinds of students, different have different makeup. And if you're going to use a method, an approach which is not appropriate to the student, it has to fail. Just like if you use a medical treatment that's not appropriate to the illness, it's going to fail. Not only will it fail, it'll make matters worse. Hence, we have this idea of categorizing. And the instruction, this is the way we should respond to the question of the wise son. Implication being that the emphasis should be on what? On the meaning of the mitzvos. That's what it says. However, if we go to the Rambam in Laws of Chametz and Matzah, chapter 7, where he discusses the mitzvah of relating the story of the Exodus, and of course he incorporates, and you shall declare them to your children on that night, the mitzvah of teaching your children, he then brings down this point that the education must be in line with the level of the child. And he gives you the illustration of the young, undeveloped child, the simple story that you tell him. Then he says, but if the son was older and more mature, he was wise, you inform him what happened to us in Egypt and the miracles that were done for us via Moshe Rabbeinu, everything in accordance with the intellectual level of the son. Now, what do you notice in that? You notice a disparity between what the Rambam is saying and what the Haggadah is including. The Rambam is not talking about teaching him any of the mitzvos. And indeed, at first glance, that seems to be the point, because the subject, it's not a time, essentially, to study about mitzvos and halacha. It's to study the story of the Exodus. As we've learned, the Ramban explains that the story contains all the foundations, the fundamentals of Judaism are contained therein. So then it's a question of what level to teach the story on, a simple level or a sophisticated level. And yet, the Haggadah, the Baal Haggadah, doesn't mention that. He says to teach him the halachos. So it seems to me that that's a disparity. The next question that I want to raise is, we've already mentioned the term vi'af, and also, given that for whatever reason the Haggadah is saying that we should teach halacha to him, what is the meaning of kihilchos ha-pesach? It should have said hilchos ha-pesach, teach him the laws of the Pesach. What do you mean kihilchos? Kihilchos is like the laws of Pesach. I guess it could mean some of the laws, a taste, so to speak, akin. What's the reason for that? And the next question is, if that is the case, well, there is a dispute whether how to read this, whether the Haggadah is saying to teach him all the laws of Pesach. That's the way the Vilna Gaon, the Gra, understood it. And in his Haggadah, he had the word kilchos ad, up until ein maftirin. That is, the idea was that you should teach him all the laws up to and including this law, that you don't have anything else to eat after the Afikoman. However, most of the Haggadahs do not have that text. And that's not the way it's commonly understood. I'm just mentioning it because that's a possible explanation, you know, that's a possible way of looking at it. I'm not adopting that approach. I'm basing myself on the standard reading, which does not have the word ad. Which means then that this particular halacha, you understand the significance of the difference. That is this particular halacha being chosen, stands out on its own, to the exclusion of other halachos? Or not? According to the Vilna Gaon, no. It's including this halacha as well, but it's including the other halachos. But the way I'm going to approach it is not based upon that. It's being based on the idea that this halacha has been chosen to stand out amongst the other ones. If that's the case, then why? What's so special about this halacha? There's many halachos, many laws. A halacha is a particular Jewish law or a practice that's mandated by the legal Jewish legal system called halacha. So what is unique about this halacha? All right, I want to pose one more question. And that is, with regard to the word eschem, because the way he frames this question is very important. It is, by virtue of how he phrases the question, that he's being defined as a chacham, which you can see. The first thing is that he recognizes that the Torah is not just an ordinary compilation of practices, but it contains tremendous wisdom. He has a recognition. And indeed, before he even speaks, he formulates his question. That's extremely important. How a person formulates their question is a very important theme of the whole Seder, as I will show you. And before he asks, he's noticed. He differentiates between different things. He's recognizing that there's different kinds of laws of the Torah, mitzvos. Those that are testimonies, then you have ordinances, then you have statutes. So, first of all, he's noticing these differences, and secondly, he's recognizing that they all form part of one system. That, too, is interesting, because testimonies, I guess one can, if it's just about testimonies, okay. So one can readily see the need for testimonies. Testimonies basically means that when significant events occur, this is true in the Torah, but it's true in mankind as well, there's a need, there are certain kinds of events which stand out above the ordinary hum, the ordinary flow of ordinary events. And they have great significance for individuals, or for families, or for nations. Usually this has to do with significant turning points in one's history or the history of a nation. When it was established, wars, victories, it could even be a defeat. Generally speaking, nations do not like to dwell on the negatives. If you'll take a note, you'll notice the various holidays we have in America, occasionally it will be, well, you do have, if someone was assassinated, like Martin Luther King Day, that's to commemorate his assassination? I'm not sure. Or his birthday? Well, I'm not sure. Generally speaking, you do have Memorial Day, but that is a different kind of a thing. It's not commemorating anything bad directly. It's a day of tribute to the soldiers who've fallen in the course of battle, so it's more of an abstract idea. It's not a sad day, I don't think, except perhaps for families that just lost relatives in the war. But the tenor of the day itself is not a day of sadness. 9/11, Memorial Day, would be sadness. Would be negative. There is no official 9/11 memorial. In most of the cases, Thanksgiving, July 4th, victories, victory in Europe, generally, it's positive things. In Judaism, we have just as many negatives. Because we have so much that centers on the destruction of the temple and the exile. That's Tisha B'Av. However, when significant events occur that make a big impact on the nation, and the lessons need to be perpetuated, so then you have to do something about that, because it's not going to keep happening over and over again. If these kinds of things would happen in every generation, the victories, etc., or even heroes, great heroic people, their birthdays, to honor them, since they're not going to be duplicated, you need to do something to memorialize so that the lessons that are contained will be perpetuated. That is the general, I mean, in a simplistic way, I'm putting it obviously very simply, that's the idea of the eidos, testimonies. They give testimony, they bear witness to significant events that occurred. So in and of itself, perhaps the Chacham would not be asking that question. The Mishpatim are ordinances. That's a different branch. The Chukim are statutes. The Chukim are statutes. Of the three categories, they're the most problematic because these are strange requirements that will impact a person as being strange. Because they don't have any obvious reason to them. And generally, when a person encounters a command, a requirement, a rule, it always has some rhyme or reason. So, the Mishpatim, the ordinances, the laws that govern interpersonal relations, and so forth, pretty much most people recognize the necessity for them. The chukim are challenging because mixing wool and linen in a garment, there's no way that anyone could see any point to that. And similar law, like meat and milk, not eating something which is meat and milk, which is part of the general question of restricted foods, why these foods are prohibited and others are permitted. What does that have to do with anything? The classical, in my opinion, the classical chok would be wool and linen, shatnez. Others may have. I understand that the paraduma, the red heifer, is cited as the biggest example of that. But on a personal level, I think the most difficult thing to explain would be shatnez. So there are, that's not the only one, there are other laws. Give me other, then the question is, what's the purpose of doing these? What's the purpose of the command? But you have all three. That's another question, in that what's interesting about Judaism is that it has different types of legislation. And usually, most religions, whatever they have, it's in one category. I don't know that and usually they have just religious kinds of rituals, ritualistic type of things. But Judaism contains all three. So what kind of a system is it? Why does Judaism have all these civil laws, for example? Laws pertaining to damages, laws pertaining to returning lost objects, and so on and so forth. These are things that most people would not associate with one's spirituality, with one's relationship to God. The things that we associate with our relationship to God have to do with what we would call religious. Generally speaking, like prayers, fasting, repentance, things of that sort. That strikes people in the religious zone, their religious zone. So this is what delineates him as a chacham. Now, why does he say that the Lord our God commanded you? And people have noted that superficially it appears that he's not that different from the wicked son, because the wicked son is defined as wicked because of that same word, lachem, to you. And that's what we say. What is this worship to you? To you and not to him. So we're taking that term very, very seriously, and the implication being that he's excluding himself from the group. However, the Chacham, the wise son, uses the same word. And yet we don't say that he excludes himself from the group. Now, the answer that everybody gives is yes, because you see, he introduces that thought with the words that the Lord, our God. So he's already including himself. He's acknowledging the Lord, our God. So therefore, we don't take the word Eschem, you, to be exclusive, that he's excluding himself. Okay, fine, that's a good answer, but then that leads us inevitably to a question. If that's the case, however, then why do we have the word eschem? It should have been osanu, us. That would be the normal logical term that the Lord our God commanded us. But he does switch, and he says, the Lord our God commanded you. So why make that switch? Why not include himself in that? I have another question, which is a simple question, and we find this a couple of times in the Haggadah, literarily speaking. Why do we describe the four sons, describe what they say in this manner? This is the introduction. Chacham Mahaomer. The Chacham, what does he say? And then we say what he says. Then we go to the Rasha. The wicked son, what does he say? The simple son, what does he say? The one that doesn't know how to ask. Well, we don't say, what does he say? He doesn't say. But why do it that way? Why do you have to ask the question that way? What does he say? Why not simply say what he says? It's an instruction on education. And what it should say is, there are four sons. The Torah spoke pertaining to four sons. The wise son, the wicked son, this son. Now, the wise son says, what are these? That's what he says. That's what I need to know. What do we have to express it that way? What does he say? This idea of introducing something with a question, when it seems unnecessary, we find the parallel later on in the Haggadah. And this is towards the latter part, where the famous statement of Rabban Gamliel would say, whoever did not say these three things on Pesach did not fulfill his obligation, and these are Pesach, Matzah, and Moror. Which means that you are obligated to elucidate the significance of these mitzvos. The meaning, the significance, the so-called reasons, ideas, the ideas that are associated with them. Then we proceed with each one. Pesach, the Pesach that our forefathers ate at the time of the temple, that it existed, for what sake? For what purpose? And then we give the answer. The same is true with the matzah. We introduce it. This matzah that we eat, for what sake? And then we give the sake. And the same with the maror. And there too, we're fulfilling an obligation of understanding the basic meaning of the mitzvos. So why don't we just say, it could have simply said, the matzah that we eat is for the sake, is because there wasn't enough time for the bread to rise in leaven, because God revealed himself to our forefathers and redeemed them immediately. So it's important to understand why we're doing it that way. Why are we expressing things that way? What does the wise son, what does he say? Just tell us what he says. And the same is true with the Pesach. Tell us the significance. Why do we use that form of question and answer? This is a very, very significant point, that the Haggadah is making a very, very big point. It's doing so in a very subtle way. The Haggadah is teaching us how to proceed in order to obtain truth. That is to say, the importance of proper methodology, the importance of questioning. Questioning is an extremely important process, and the appropriate, it's not just questioning, but to achieve, to question in the proper way. What the Haggadah is telling you is that it's extremely significant, it's very, very important for a person to arrive at truth. That's what Torah is all about. It's the communication of truths. These truths are communicated through the various commandments and so on and so forth. And we have to implement these truths. But first we have to understand them. And the way to arrive at truth is through perfecting yourself to the greatest extent possible in correct methodology of thinking. That's a very, very big point, and very few people pay any attention to it at all. Very few people in the world are concerned about developing a proper methodology for thinking. Yet this is the foundation. It's the foundation of Judaism. Without it, Judaism really can't survive in the appropriate way. And it will lead to distortions, which indeed we see today. We suffer from the tremendous distortions of Judaism. That's one of the great tragedies of history, which we still have in our age. The distortion of Judaism, which is the religion of truth. But people do not approach it for the sake of truth, and they distort it. And even those who recognize it, if you don't have the proper methodology, it becomes extremely difficult. That's what the Haggadah, see, the Haggadah, everything we do is being done through question and answer. Because there is a methodology that has to be used. Now you see, in general, in the world in general, sheer intellectual power, sheer brain power, that's important, but it's not the most important thing. Every person has the capacity, unless the person is mentally damaged, but every person with a normal intelligence, and this is the foundation of the Torah, has the capacity to become a chacham. To become a chacham. So it's not like there's four groupings and they're static, they're interchanging positions. That is, if you develop the appropriate methodology of thinking, if you train yourself, it's like anything else. And the person with proper methodology and training will have a much greater chance of arriving at the truth than another individual with superior ability and talent who does not train and work very hard. But you see, very few people even recognize this. In the world at large, you will see that now you can understand a lot about the different aspects of the Haggadah, the style of the Haggadah. Questions, answers, sources. And that is it's training something. That everything begins with the appropriate question. After you have raised the proper question, which is extremely, extremely important because it puts you in a certain direction. I always emphasize that. The first step in analysis is question. And there's many different kinds of question, but you have to understand what's the appropriate question. That's a very, very significant aspect. I'm always emphasizing what is the right question. Because people have a lot of questions. They can be good questions, but that's a side point, whatever it is. It's a curiosity. The right question in uncovering the material. Train people in every area. A detective, we could be at the same crime scene. We'll ask a lot of questions, but the detective will know what the real questions are. That's a significant question. Because the question takes note of a certain observation, observes that something is not consistent. So there's different kinds of questions. The phenomena lend themselves to the question, the formulation of the proper question. That's extremely important. But you will see that most people, in terms of how much methodology they use in their thinking, will depend. People, generally speaking, use methodology when they're forced to. You'll see that in business, people that are successful in business or professions, so obviously their money is on the line. They don't just make these big decisions on the basis of any thought that enters their mind or superficial kind of thinking. They test it out, they study, they listen, they develop methods of analyzing something. However, when it comes to another area, and this area is more important, the area of values, the purpose of life, you'll see, have a discussion, raise any question, everybody has an answer, and they can be intelligent, but if you start to question, you'll see that they haven't scrutinized their own views. That I find amazing. Most people, when it comes to the most significant areas of life, they haven't used the methodology and perfected their way of thinking and tested their ideas. That's pretty much what Socrates demonstrated in the dialogues. He would challenge people and question people. And he would, on the basis of a simple scrutiny, their ideas could not hold up to simple scrutiny. So one of the messages of the Haggadah, and you see it, Chacham, what does he say? That is, there's a methodology. There's a way of thinking, and the Torah contains within itself the system of correct thinking, and training a person in methodology. And it's through this methodology that a person transforms himself into a chacham. And the methodology should be applied in all areas. There's no exception to the rule. The chacham is the one who recognizes chachma, who recognizes wisdom, and in any area that he turns to, he applies it. That's what it says about David. Vahi David l'chol derachav maskil. That David in all of his ways was a rational thinker. He thought rationally. Vashem imo, and God was with him. That is a significant idea that ought to be communicated at the Seder. The Haggadah is proclaiming the significance that of methodology, and that is the task of each individual to perfect his thinking apparatus. Why? Because he was designed for truth. And the only way he can arrive at truth is through the mind, and there is an appropriate methodology by which the mind can arrive at truth. Even the given that we have the Torah, the fact that we have the Torah, it's a direction. It's direction. It reveals to us important information, but if we don't approach it correctly, then we'll just have a superficial understanding of it. We probably will distort it. The person does not know how to differentiate between ideas and between emotions, for example, which is a fundamental lesson. And you see, now you can understand when you hear certain rabbis and what's popular in the world today, so-called philosophies of Judaism being presented by intelligent people. And it's appealing. But the reason why you'll see it's a combination of there is certain logic there and it's pleasing to the emotions, emotionalism as well. There are many people out there today who represent Judaism to others and they're not using this approach. That it's a system of truth. And we have to be very scrupulous in terms of elucidating what the Torah is saying. That is what the Haggadah is, a model of that. That's why so much of the Haggadah is based upon going back to the sources and using exegesis, the appropriate exegesis, to establish what the truth is. That there is a method that has to be used and that it is essential for each Jew, to the extent that it's possible, to train themselves in appropriate thinking. That's why everything begins with a question. And then you pause and think, use your own mind. What do you think? What do you think a chacham is? What defines the chacham for you? What do you think the wicked one is? And believe me, these are very startling answers, because nobody in the world today would categorize the son, the second son, the wicked son this way. Nobody. To the contrary, many people would characterize him as the righteous son, just because he asks a question. And just because he's putting forth the notion that this is okay for you and there's other systems for others, pluralism, it's quite clear that the Russia essentially is a pluralist. Seems to be what he's saying. So that's a good question when you get to the Russia. What is it about him that's wicked? Maybe he's mistaken, but why is he wicked? The idea that such a person would be wicked is very challenging. Now I'm going to see if we can answer some of these questions that we've raised and put it all together. With regard to the first question, that is, that he uses the word you, that our Hashem, our God, commanded you. This is another defining characteristic of the wise. The wise are defined by their intellectual and moral virtues. And wisdom is based upon very significant moral virtues, the most important being humbleness. A person that's not humble is limited in terms of his knowledge and wisdom, will not obtain wisdom. Because true wisdom demands that a person be completely committed to the objective truth, whether it goes against his own thoughts. He has to be able to relinquish his own thoughts, ideas which he thought were so beautiful and wonderful, once he discovers that they're not upheld. Also, he must be extremely humble to submit to the authorities in any area, to the teachers. That's the recognition over here. This shows his recognition. It's the Lord our God commanded you in the sense that I do not have direct access to this body of wisdom. There's a system that's been established, the system of the oral law. And only they have the appropriate methodologies and approaches and exegetical principles and so on and so forth. And in order for me to gain that knowledge, I must subordinate myself to the legitimate teachers. Well, that's a big problem we have today, that many people, many so-called religious leaders, obviously among the non-Orthodox denominations, but you'll find that even amongst the so-called Orthodox, the extent to which they deviate, and they just want to create their own ideas. They want to project their own ideas and try to pretend that this is what the Torah is saying. To be able to keep your own creativity, your own personal creativity and ego in check. Now bear in mind another thing that's very important. He's not asking for explanations. The Chacham is not asking for just any explanation. That is to say, it's not like you go to a rabbi and say, explain this to me. And the rabbi comes up with something, and it's very, very impressive and interesting. Ah, that's a very good answer. Thank you. I like your explanation. That's your explanation. He's not asking for your explanation. He's not asking for my explanation. He's at, what is it that's been communicated throughout the generations which traces itself all the way back to Sinai? I want that explanation. That's what's so important, that the Seder, we're reaffirming the oral law, the validity of the oral law, as well as the written law. Eschem, what did he command you? What did God command you? I'm not asking you what you think. There's a big difference. And that's not to say that what you think has no validity. You can go to someone and let me think about that. And I can come up with an interesting answer. Not based upon sources, whatever. I just thought about it. It can be very good. It can be useful. It could contain truth. But that's not what he's asking for. He's asking for what has been transmitted throughout the generations. The authentic Masorah. That's what he's asking for. And again, you can see that explains that the course of the Haggadah from this point on, everything is going to be based upon sources. Sources and legitimate exegesis, the rabbis, the legitimate authorities in every generation. That's why he says Eschem. It's the Lord our God, but he set up a system in which I must humble myself and subordinate myself to your teachings. You are the teachers, you are my teachers. To accept the teachers on this night, that's extremely important. I want to continue now and try and explain the word vi'af. This is my own theory. The Baal HaGadah obviously is not, and the Rambam is not contradicting the Baal HaGadah and so forth. What the Rambam is saying has to be correct, that the essence of the discussion is about the story. The story has to do with the narrative, the enslavement, the miracles. It's not, the essence of the evening is not to study halacha. If a person just got together and studied halacha that night, I don't think he fulfilled the mitzvah properly, or fulfilled it at all, except perhaps indirectly. And the Rambam didn't mention the halacha. But I think that the point of the af, and I'm just suggesting this, I don't know if I ever said it before, and also presupposes that something has come before it. That is, you should tell him the story on an in-depth level. The af, and also because of his attitude towards the system and his recognition that it contains wisdom, you should also include the chachma of the halacha, that there's a tremendous wisdom in the halachic system. That's why it's kihilchos, like. That is, to demonstrate to him the great wisdom that's contained in the mitzvos, and that the mitzvos contain tremendous insight and wisdom, and they too tell the story in their own way. They serve to tell the story of the Exodus. So according to the way I'm learning it, it's an addition. So it's conveying to you that you should tell him the story in accordance to lead him towards a greater understanding in terms of the abstract, the conceptualization. And it says, and also included should be elucidation of some of the laws of Pesach to demonstrate this point. Now the question, if that is correct, it would be the Haggadah is giving you two things. One, the idea, and this is also a significant element of the Haggadah, to communicate the abstract idea and then an illustration. It always does that. That's another major theme of the educational, the idea and the illustration. If that's the case, what's unique about this particular halacha? The halacha that you cannot eat anything after the afikoman. That is, the Seder ends, the eating part ends with the afikoman. From that point on, you're not permitted to eat or drink. You only have the 2 cups of wine, because that's a halachic kind of drinking. But other than that, you can't drink water. The reason being is that the reason that's given for this halacha, with regard to originally the Karban Pesach, the Passover sacrifice, and now with the afikoman, is that the taste should remain with you. Before we go any further, just by choosing this halacha, just by mentioning it, you see something about the halachic system itself. This halacha, on the most simple level, teaches you something about the halachic system itself. You learn a lot from this halacha, because the average individual would ask, how can a piece of matzah substitute for this Passover lamb? It's the lamb, it's the sacrifice, it's been roasted. How can this substitute for that? The mere fact that you can have such a thing, that we really don't care that much whether we're reading that or we're reading this, and that on the surface they have nothing in common with each other, teaches you that the essence of the halachic system is the abstract concepts that the objects represent, but there's nothing inherent, there's nothing mystical or magical about any particular substance. That one can obtain the basic benefit. That is not to say that when the temple is rebuilt, we will have the sacrifices. That is not to say that it's superior that way. But it shows you that the nature of the whole system of mitzvos is based upon very abstract concepts. With regard to the meaning of this halacha, I'm going to share with you something one of my students who happens to go to Rabbi Pesach Chait, Rabbi Chait's son's shir. They were learning the area halachically about the laws of not eating. You can have water, as I said, to retain the taste. So he said, I think he quoted it in the name of his Rebbe, that taste has a certain signification. I'm going to cite the idea. I think it's a good idea. And I'm going to sort of bolster it with certain supports. That it means that the taste should endure. When you taste something, and that taste has a significance, and you say, I want to keep that taste in my mouth, it conveys the idea that the experience that I've had should endure. So that another purpose and objective of the Seder, as we've said, and we have said this all along, that the objective of the mitzvah, of the sefer, of the telling, is to effectuate a change in the person, that the person views it as though he left, which has an impact upon him, and he has this sense of absolute appreciation and gratitude to God, so he emerges as a new type of a person. That's what we've said, and this fits in with this idea that he's changed, that it effectuates a change of his emotional state, and that's the idea that you want to continue. It should endure. Now, to bolster that, that's with taste. That's what we're saying taste represents. It is interesting that the term taste, tam, occurs in the book of Tehillim, Psalms. For example, this is Psalm 34, which we recite every Shabbos in the Shachar service. It's one of the first of the Psukei de Zimra. And it's L'David b'shanoso as tam o'lefnei Avimelech, a song of David when he feigned madness before Avimelech, who drove him out and he departed. You can go into the story. That's when he was being pursued by Saul, King Saul, and he had to run away, and he found refuge under the kingship of Avimelech, who was his enemy, because he had defeated the Philistines. And in order to avoid punishment, he came up with the scheme that he would feign madness. And the Tanakh describes that once the king found out that he had lost his mind, he had no desire to hurt him anymore. It was, I don't need any madmen. It's an interesting psychological ploy. I think the idea being is that, other than that, he would have killed him. But when you have anger at someone, when you retain a grudge and you want revenge, it directs itself at a certain kind of a person. You have a certain image in your mind of the person and his emotions and what he thought of you and all that, and you can't wait to see him harmed. But if that person were to become senile and he's not the same person anymore, so then there's no gratification. Because that's not the same image. It's physically the same person, but now it's a totally different image, so there's no enjoyment. To the contrary, you leave him alone. It would be demeaning of you then to take it out on him, because it wouldn't satisfy. You want to get that person the way they were and with the same attitude towards you, and you want to inflict pain on them. Because basically you want them to acknowledge that they were wrong, or to take it back. But if the person doesn't have his mind anymore, he's not the same person, as though he's dead. Even a corpse, a person, if a person were to come upon the corpse of an enemy, in a rage he would stomp on it. Because that is more closely associated, he still retains the image. But once the person doesn't have his mind anymore, and he's functioning like a complete moron, there's nothing, that image is gone. It's dissipated. It has to do with image. But nevertheless, it uses the word tamo, literally his taste. So what does that mean, his taste? So it seems to me that it's similar, because everybody, it means the flavor. You have a certain flavor, how other people perceive you. Each person creates a certain flavor. It could be a pleasant aroma, or it could be an unpleasant. There are some people that, when they're around, you feel positive, or sometimes you feel they make you feel uncomfortable. Each person produces a certain taste in somebody else's mind. I think that's what it's referring to. When he changed his taste, meaning how people would sense him, the sense that he would evoke in people. In that very same chapter, a few lines down, it says, Tamu uru'u, taste and see. Ki tov ad Hashem, that God is good. Ashrei hageva, fortunate is the person who trusts in him, who seeks shelter in him. What does that mean, taste and see? So in this siddur it says, consider and see. And the art scroll says, contemplate and see. So really it means, think. Think about the phenomena. Study the miracles of God and how God protects people, and you will see how fortunate the person is. But again it says, tamu, to taste. What does that mean, to taste? The significance is that what the Torah is something that you have to partake of to experience it in a manner that you really indulge and you enjoy it, and it leaves a taste in your mouth. That's what it's talking about. It's comparing the Torah to an entity, something which is delicious and satisfying and has a pleasant taste. That's the extent, that's the way we should relate to the Torah. As though the Torah was some beautiful, fine meal to indulge ourselves in it. Enjoying it. Experiencing it. That's what he means. Tamu, taste. And that could be the reason. The meaning, the idea that to the Ben Chacham, you choose. It doesn't have to be this halacha. My interpretation. Kihilchos. That it also should include the halachic. Because it should be a total experience. And people have a bit of a negative experience about the halachic. That's why I'm saying that it doesn't mean, I'm giving an opinion which would differ with the Gra, with the Vilna Gaon, that not to study all the laws of the Pesach. That's not the point tonight. That he has to study so he'll know every single halacha. No, but it's kihilchos. It's to get a taste. That there shouldn't be in his mind an area which is alien. That all the areas of Torah are enjoyable and make sense, reflect the ideals of Torah, reflect the philosophy of Torah. And this particular halacha reflects that idea, that there is a transformation of the person, that the result of the Seder experience the telling of the story, the performing of the mitzvah that are associated with it, is to make a certain transformation in the person, and that should be a lasting phenomenon. It should last. It should remain. It shouldn't just be a fleeting phenomenon. Which is the lesson that a true chacham is someone who persists. Sometimes you have a moment of inspiration, and in that moment you're prepared to, you see life differently, and all of your values are appropriate and they're in line, but then the moment passes. Because as it passes, then another experience and another experience. So sometimes it's telling you that you have to linger. Don't eat something else. Don't block out that taste. Let that taste remain. Let it linger and continue. The whole objective of becoming a chacham means to continue. There's no one evening that's going to do it for you. The purpose of the evening is to redirect yourself in terms of your goals, newfound goals, to continue and to implement the inspiration.